You're listening to Confessing Animals with Jen Harris and Vanessa Arrico, rebel poets, real rebels, really talking poets, rebelling and listening.
Okay, don't interrupt me.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Confessing Animals. I am Vanessa Arrico.
And I am Jen Harris.
And this is Confessing Animals.
I was just sitting here waiting for something to happen. Who speaks?
I am. This is what I'm supposed to do. Welcome to another episode of Confessing Animals, a series of conversations with writers navigating the writing life. Each episode reveals uniquely individual approaches and insights and all sorts of shenanigans into creativity and life and access and whirlwinds of sparkly dust in the desert.
Now I feel like you've gone off script. Okay. There's no way you wrote that down and hit save.
Listen, today I'm Vanessa Arrico.
We're done. We know you're Vanessa Arrico. That part is never in question. Oh my God. I told you last episode we needed to pre-record this, and I remain strong on that, but also I love fucking this up with you. It's my favorite part of our podcast.
I totally agree. I just do it for the intro.
All right. Well, okay. Beyond us loving each other, today we have another guest. Thank God. Waleska Beretta. Her stage name is Waleska Font. She, her, hers. Waleska is a Venezuelan multidisciplinary artist. She is a cultural promoter, copy editor, teacher, and poet, having performed in Mexico, Venezuela, and Kansas City. Her work explores the limitations of bilingualism, sexuality, culture, and identity. She's currently a board member of No Divide Kansas City and a sponsored artist for Poetry for Personal Power. Her Instagram, W as in Waleska, L as in Larry, S-K-A, Font, that's F-O-N-T. So check her out. I feel like this was one of the best interviews we've had, in that I've never had a more authentic conversation with somebody whom I have seemingly only poetry in common with. I don't know. I just wasn't expecting to be as stunned as I am. I was expecting for her to come in and give us a hell of an interview, but I feel like shook by what she shared with us today.
I agree. She's definitely, I needed this today. I was in a weird funk, and just like her beautiful pink hair, like she brought some, I don't know. I described it earlier. I was having synesthesia experiencing Waleska. Like she was bright and beautiful and arresting and charming and intelligent and insightful and everything you could hope for in a guest. And yeah, like again, this is a guest I've never met. So, you know, I'm always up for a challenge of walking into something that I have like no idea what I'm getting into. And what a joy she was to talk to.
Yeah, and her poetry is beautiful. So I'm excited that we have, because it's been a couple of episodes since we've had somebody really read anything. It's been a while, and I yeah. feel like her work is, it's such an important voice. And I mean, I know she's headed to great places, so I'm glad we got to talk to her while she's still on the ground with us.
So
we're getting into this interview with Waleska. Yeah, you're welcome.
You're welcome.
You can't see me lean into my mic. There's no video anymore. You're welcome. All right, let's get into this interview with Waleska Font. Tell me about, I would love to talk about your immigration journey if you would like to talk about it, but I don't want to assume that. So I guess I'm curious, you know, you said you left Kansas City, you moved to St. Louis, and you are not from Kansas City or St. Louis. So I'd love to start there because your work is so richly influenced by your Venezuelan culture and heritage. And I would love to talk about you in your many identities.
Well, I was in Venezuela for the first 21 years of my life. I was born and raised there my whole life. And then things started getting really bad because of the government situation there. And my mom got a job offer in Mexico. And she was like, should I take it? And we were like, yes, please take it. And it was really hard because my mom had taken my whole life since I was 6 years old. We built a house together. So from when I was six to when I was 21, when we moved. So it was, we spent this whole, all these years building our house, and she, you know, she had a career and she was doing her thing. And it was just like, she did it for me because she knew that if we stayed, it was going to be really hard for us to, for me to actually like start a life. So we moved to Mexico, and that was a whole journey because I was in college. I had been in college for 3 years in Caracas by then. And when I got to Mexico, I got revalidated. Some of that was like a year, an equivalent of a year. And then I had to start over, basically. So I've been in college for a while. I just graduated on October 2020, and it was amazing, finally.
Congratulations. That's
congratulations.
Tremendous.
Yeah. Yeah, but I found that it doesn't matter like how many turns life takes, you always learn something new. And it was a very hard lesson to learn because I felt like I was, you know, a failure. Like, because in my head, I was going to be 25 married with kids, right? When you're a kid and you think that's like how it's going to be. And then I was like, I'm graduating when I'm 26 and like I haven't done anything with my life. I was just so stressed about that. And I was like, hey, you've done a lot.
Also, you've survived a lot.
Yeah, I was going to say, can you take us back maybe to, like, could you paint more of a picture of Venezuela for us and some people that maybe might not know what the culture is like there, or why it was so hard, or why you would be leaving? And, I mean, could we maybe go into a little bit of that?
Yeah, of course. I know there's a lot of misinformation, especially because of the media and all the censorship that we have. So, you know, long story short, I guess the point of it is that it's a dictatorship, an extreme leftist dictatorship led by Hugo Rafael Chavez, who passed away, I think it was 2013 or something like that. He'd been in power for a long ass time, and he just kept reelecting himself, you know, in a very corrupted way. And he took most of the private industry, which left us with little near to no product in the country, because those things weren't changing to having production by the people or anything like that. It was just left to die or given to some of the people that were in that circle to get themselves more rich. So that was like, you know, our economy declined completely, where we have had the highest hyperinflation in history ever. It's insane. And you couldn't really find food. And then because of the lack of production, you had to make these long lines and wake up in the middle of the night to start at 3 a.m. doing that. And then they started regulating when you could buy things, determined by the last number of your ID. So in my case, my ID ended in 9, which meant that I could only buy certain items of food on Fridays or Sundays. And but all of that was a lot of stress, and I had started college by then. I had moved for the first time of my life in a different city, in the capital, to study literature because I decided I want to be a doctor at some point when I was young. And then I was 2 years into that, and I was like, I don't want to do this. And then I moved alone, and all these things happened. It's been a journey. But what happened with that was basically that the lack of food was like a really hard thing, but we figured it out. My family is amazing, so we helped each other a lot when somebody didn't have something. And But the thing that was the scariest was safety-wise, like, there was this point where I remember that we were sleeping with a machete under the bed. And I actually have a poem where I talk about that because it was insane. Like, when I moved to Mexico, and I went to a psychiatrist for the first time in my life, and my psychiatrist was like, I don't think you realize that you suffer from PTSD. And I was like, huh?
Right. That kind of information is not presented to you when you're living in basically a war zone.
No. And, you know, I really find very disturbing when people start to compete to see which country is worse. And I'm like, hear me out. Everybody's a little fucked, okay? Some are worse than others. Yes, I agree yes. with you. But I really don't want to get into a fight with you about why my country is worse than yours or yours is worse than mine. I'm just telling you that if some countries were really as bad as you think, people weren't running away from their homes to these places to try to create a home on their own. I think we forget that part, you know, and we really forget how lucky and blessed we are sometimes.
I've gone back to this poem quite a bit, but the poem Home by Warson Shire. Are you familiar with that poem?
Mm-mm.
I will text it to you, but the first stanza is, I mean, no one gave us permission to read this on air, but I'm going to do it anyway. Home. No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. You only run for the border when you see the whole city running as well. And it talks about fleeing your country on the basis of government tyranny. And it's, I don't think people realize how fragile the world is because Americans are so spoiled like that. There's been no war on this soil other than the disaster and catastrophe of 9/11 since, you know, the Civil War. So there's, you know, there's no sense of fear like that. There's no sense of like, people don't look at their economy and think about its possibility of true crumble, of ration, of, they don't understand that at all. There's so much even faux wealth and faux abundance, like this notion of having more shit is wealth in this country, but also you can't eat any of that furniture that you have when it all comes down, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was actually talking about this stuff tonight. Like, I think it's insane how much money people spend here and how little it means to everybody and how we do not prioritize things that are important. Like, I don't know, growing food for yourself, you know, right. I learned that the hard way, unfortunately, but I know how to do it now. It's just, don't get me wrong, but the soil here is really hard to work with. Like in the Midwest, mm-hmm. I haven't found, but I really want to learn because I know it's possible. It's just very different from the one that I have worked with before.
Yeah, we lack basic survival skills here. Like I thought a lot about that as soon as we went into lockdown for a pandemic, you know, like we tried to grow food. Our backyard is so poisoned. We couldn't even do it. You know what I mean? But just like you become so aware of the meaninglessness of all the accumulated stuff we have here, especially in America. But like our lack of knowledge of anywhere else, of any other country, of how any of it actually works. You know what I mean? Like, you know, we say Venezuela, you know, you want to say Syria, you want to like, you name anywhere else in this world and we're not educated at all on any kind of reality of what it's like for people living anywhere else. Like we're so stuck in our own bubble. Like I really feel like we are the least educated when it comes to anybody else in the world.
We're entirely, it's all the privilege. It's all the privilege. It's all of the spoiled and what we value. You know what I mean? Like I wrote about that during the pandemic. You can tell what a culture values by what's open during a pandemic. Schools are closed. Target is open. You know, like there's just this notion of this is what really matters, quote unquote, to us. And it's
the liquor stores gross. Have never closed and they never will.
Right.
It's insane.
Right. But the, yeah, the absolute inability to truly care for yourself. I get very disturbed in being back in the Midwest about having all this land and not utilizing it for anything that would be truly beneficial, like wind energy or solar energy or community gardens being more of a regular thing. I know it's happening in Kansas City, but I went out to the West Coast of this country and, you know, there's community gardens everywhere, everywhere in the PNW. They're growing their own food and people are using their yards for that because that's what it should be for. You don't need an enormous plot of land to what? To fucking mow? To waste gas on and waste time on? Like, what are you doing? This is where you can grow your survival. And people do not take advantage of that at all.
A big issue that it comes to humanity. I don't understand why us as humans don't really work on these things unless we have to. And I don't know how to fix that, but I've been a teacher for quite a while. And that's one of the things that I try to tell my students all the time is that you don't need to be, you know, hitting rock bottom to try to figure out what would you would do if you were there. Because we need awareness of a lot of things. And I think we also need to understand that all these this privilege is made up. These things are made up. It's not like you were born having all this access to all these things. These necessities are made up by marketing. Also, I've been working on marketing lately and I realize how awful it is.
Vanessa and I both have jobs in that industry.
Yeah, it's creepy and it's scary. It's scary. And it's scary how much we need it as artists nowadays too, because it's like if you're not on social media, you don't exist, and it's a thing. It's reality, and it hurts a lot because your work is not based anymore on how hard you work on it or how educated you try to be on it. It's more about if the algorithm is going to like it or not, if you can sell it.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's such a false perpetuation of this lie, though. Like, that also is made up. Like the algorithm is real. Like, if you don't post your face every day, the algorithm's not going to serve you up, right? But, like, the way that the free advertising that Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg have gotten, because we all say, check out my Facebook. We say Facebook more than our own name. We promote Facebook more than we promote our own work. And that's a lie because people did it before. Facebook will turn into something else one day. And like you said, it's not about merit anymore. And the cream cannot rise to the top because it's all weighted down by this perceived democratization of, oh, now we all have access and it's free and yada, yada, yada. Well, let me tell you, if something's free, you're the product. So, you know, like this is not some great benefit that we're all receiving. And I
girl, hang on. Jesus Christ. If something's free, you're the product is like tattoo it on my titties. Like that was such a fucking line, bitch. Write it down.
No, it's not me. I'm not going to take credit for it because I mean, that's the reality. If you read any of the media theorists nowadays, you know, Douglas Rushkoff, I mean, any number of philosophers or media theorists have all been telling us this. Jared Lanier, he created virtual reality in the internet, basically, and he's against it. Like, we know the dangers, we know the harm, but still people are just like, you know, the fascists and the dictatorship and like these weird words we use with each other about follows and likes and we're content and we're shoppers and we're not people. There's no human language in any of this interaction. There is no social and social media. We're all just selling each other fucking crap and we're trying to sell ourselves. But what we're really selling is the platform.
My crap are these sensitive poems I've written.
What Vanessa's saying, really, like, oh, you're the product, that just clicked in my brain because one of the things that was the hardest for me to realize and when I became a feminist, it wasn't when I was in Mexico, because of course we have misogynist people in Venezuela. Of course we do. We're like, you know, that's everywhere. But in Mexico, I realized it more because of how close I was with, Mexican people, and their biggest issue, I think, right now is probably how many women are disappearing and are found dead. Like, you know, it was happening as near as in every single faculty of the college that I made myself a home of at the time that I was there. And it's very, very, very scary. And that's when I started like really thinking about these things. Like you become the product, because it's, you know, I always heard this argument like, oh yeah, but women have it easier because you don't pay at the club. And how do you say that? Femicide. And stuff like that. And it's like, no, the reason why you don't pay at the club is because they want more men buying alcohol there so they can take you home and do whatever they want with you. Like,
exactly.
you drink free so you get drunker faster and people can do whatever they want with you, you know? And this crazy thing that I realized when I was in Mexico was that it's like how fragile it is to be a woman in Latin America sometimes. It's like, or children, like the amount of people that just went missing the whole time that I was there. And still, like, I still have, you know, all my friends and social media, as we were talking. And it's like every single day, there's tons and tons of women that are missing or found dead. Because if they find you, trust me, just only 1% of them are found. Like, oh yeah, I don't know, they forgot their phone. That never happens, okay? Nobody's faking this. And which is something that makes me so mad is when they're like, no, there's some women that are fake this. Yeah, sure, but have you heard of sex trafficking? Do you know where that's coming from? Do you know what's happening with that?
And same thing here in the States, you know, with all the missing indigenous women who are, they're missing, they're found dead, like nobody talks about it. And, you know, while we just parade around the annual blonde baby that's missing that people care about.
Yeah. And the only way to be saved of this is if you have privilege, which is why it's happening in certain places to certain people, you know. If you have the privilege to have a car, you're in less risk because you're not in public transportation. You don't have to walk from the bus stop to your house. You don't have to walk from the bus stop to where you go to work, from where you go to school. You privilege is the only thing stopping you from not getting killed.
Well, and that's what's it's impossible to communicate that to people within the privilege spectrum, right? Like people who expected to have a car at 16 and expect to have a car now do not understand the inherent value of that is not just your independence, which is that's the cornerstone of the American foundational conversation, right? It's like, we're independent, we're free, we can do what we want. And it's like, well, the ways in which this prevents you from in any way experiencing what's really happening in this country is astounding.
I think that, as I was saying before, every country has its problems. And I honestly think that's because everybody is human and we are a little crazy in the head, and we're very selfish and we are very egotistical. But I think the thing that nobody really thinks about is it's how hard it is to leave everything and start over. And I know a lot of my friends who also left Venezuela, because I can count with my hands the amount of friends that I have still there. Like all of them, they're all around the world now. Luckily, they found another home. But a lot of them, I have one friend who came back because she really didn't find herself where she went to. She went to, I can't remember the country. It was an island country. And she just hated herself outside of Venezuela. And that's valid too, you know? So she went back with her fiance, and then she started her own business. And she's like the number one in that business now in Venezuela. And I'm so proud of her. And I don't know how she does it, but it's not for everybody. But also it's really hard. A lot of people have gone to different countries. I have a lot of friends who went to Chile and then they moved to Argentina and on, because also you finding a home is really, really hard. And finding people that can be a support for you, a place where you can be part of a community. And that is what I found in Kansas City that was so valuable to me. I found a community of artists that really, really helped me out and made me realize that I could do more with what I was creating. And that's something that I'm very grateful for.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? I know that you work You're a board of director for, or a board member for No Divide, and you guys recently got a cultural producers grant. So maybe you could talk to us about what that all means.
Yeah. Well, I met No Divide where I met Jen at Queer Narratives Festival, the second Queer Narratives Festival. Oh, that was so great. It was the first time that I performed in English. And I was so nervous because I had
you did such a phenomenal job. Ugh, you took that whole stage by storm.
It was thanks to your music stand, because that's when I got one for myself, by the way, after I realized that I needed one. Because when I saw you with that, I was like, I should have that. What am I doing? I worked enough to invest in one. It was great.
That makes my heart so happy.
Yes, you taught me. You taught me, Jen. Thank you. I'm doing a little bow. You can see me, but I'm bowing.
sweet girl.
So No Divide took me in as their child. That's what I'm going to say. I love Stacey and I love Emily and Tanith. They're amazing people, all of them. And they really, really took me in. And one thing that Stacey said, not because I'm like, I think I'm starting my career and like really baby chicken starting my career. But one thing that Stacey said one time that was like really, it warmed my heart a lot was that she's like, I think this is really what No Divide is about. It's like how we are capable of starting people's careers. And honestly, I know, you know, I do believe that you have to work hard for your things. But also if there are no opportunities for you, that working hard thing is going to be, it's going to be impossible to go somewhere. And right. I think the greatest thing about No Divide is that they create opportunities, paid opportunities for artists, for local artists. I think that's something that we need to keep doing in everywhere we are. And I'm working on St. Louis right now, trying to see what I'm going to do here and where is going to be my place here, because it took me a long time to find my place in Kansas City. And right when I thought I had found it, I was like,
hey, kind of Melissa, like I know so many people in St. Louis, though, and I'm so excited to connect you with people.
Yeah.
Yeah. See? I mean, there's a tremendous poetry community in St. Louis, and there's Mid-America Arts Alliance has a branch of Artist Inc. that's starting from Kansas City to St. Louis. I'm going to be teaching and facilitating that. So like, you're in a great place. You're in a great place. And there's a lot more diversity. There's diversity in Kansas City, but I think everybody, they have a tendency to separate out into their own like best friends clubs. There's a lot of clickiness in Kansas City, as I'm sure there is in other cities, but I feel like St. Louis has more of an open arms energy. So all good things.
Yeah. I think that my relationship with Kansas City is a little bit when you're like, you end up a relationship with someone, but you love them so much still, and you know that your lives are always going to be connected, but you just have to go separate ways, and that's okay, and you both wish the best for the other. Yeah, I'm just trying to find my place here.
You've made such a valid you focused on or amplified the importance of community in your immigration experience. You know, you're both forced and intentional immigration, like these communities of people that find like hold you along the way and get you to where you're going, even if it's interstate, even if it's in the same country. Like these are the ways in which we endure major change, if not catastrophe. So like the part, I feel like if no one has told you what an incredibly brave thing it is you're doing, like it's the genuine definition of courage that you are where you are right now, Waleska. Like it is, your story is incredible. And your experience is, I think, from this side of the table, your story is almost unimaginable. And I want to acknowledge that, and that you seeking community, I mean, people would be lucky to know you and lucky to work with you. And I'm excited for the people that you root down with.
Yeah, thank you. I know that in my journey, I've been very privileged, because the way why I moved to Mexico is because my mom got a job opportunity. You know, my mom is the best mom. I know everybody says that, but my mom is the best mom. And she has supported me through all of my different phases in life. And, you know, it's just, we don't have the best mom-daughter relationship, but she's always been there for me. Like when I said, Mom, I don't want to be a doctor anymore. I want to be a poet.
She was like, wait, what?
Yeah. No, it was hard on her, but she supported me. At the end, she's like, okay, I have your back. When we moved to Mexico, she had my back. You know, she let me borrow the car because I was starting a little farther where she was working, like an hour and a half from there. Then she helped me out with where to stay. Then I came here and she still helps me out because she knows that I'm waiting on all this stuff to be figured out. Like, no, my mom has always had my back. And I know that I'm very privileged to have her because I know people who have had to do this with little to no help. And I, as brave as this can sound, I know that I have been very privileged through it. And
I think it's a delicate and beautiful thing because you can't, the comparison is unfair in that way of like, we all have our journeys. So, you know, just being like, I've got it good because mine wasn't as hard. I don't want to diminish how hard you've worked and what you've been through. But I totally understand what you're saying.
It's so amazing too, because, you know, earlier when you mentioned, like, you know, I'm not going to argue with like you whose country is more repressed or fucked up than the next, right? But also it's just like the demands that have been put on you and your family and millions of other people and families because of these conditions that force you away from home and to even like recognize like there is still even a hierarchy in that experience that you're like, well, I've been privileged or have had more of an experience. You know what I mean? Like there is still that constant hierarchy or comparison or like stratification of like struggle, right? Like it's heartbreaking because like I truly don't think anybody here in America whose family didn't immigrate from somewhere else, or like if we were forced off our land, if we were forced to leave our houses today and we had to go to another country that we didn't speak the language and we didn't know how to navigate and we didn't have any community, you know, like I really don't think that is something that our country has like fully even thought about on like a severe level of like understanding. Like
Well, every state you go to generally speaks your language. So these many United States, you still are not forced into any sort of like a sense of discomfort is very limited to your surroundings and not to your understanding of the culture. Right.
Well, here again with the media and the marketing and the strip mall, the United States is so big, but you can go state to state to state and your Starbucks and your McDonald's and that strip mall is the same no matter where you go. So you never truly have to leave your comfort zone because there's always a store that you walk into that you know. There's always a place that you visit that's exactly like it was back home, right? So like it's disorienting because you could travel thousands and thousands of miles and you're still in the same fucking spot.
Yeah, I can't believe I, like, what was it? Like 5 hours, 4 hours, 30 minutes, and I'm still in the same state, but it's a completely different life. It's so insane.
Right. Yeah.
It's too big. Let's make America small again. I don't know.
Hey, I'm completely down. There's some states I'd be happy to fucking get rid of for sure. I would like to belong to the state of Oregon for the rest of my life. Yeah. It did me good, you know? It's beautiful there. I love everything about it. I think the government is good. I think the energy is wonderful. You know, but that's the thing is we're all looking for home. And I think there's a lot of... Like Americans don't travel. That's they don't travel nearly as much as people in the EU do for sure. But I don't know. I think that there's this value of home and community and local that the entire world has lost control of in some way. Like in order to become famous without social media, you become the poet where you're from and you stay there and you work and they honor that. And that's your role in the community, right? But there's this energy created by our like global connection that suggests that if you're not internationally known in every corner of the world, you don't exist at all. And so I think it's really interesting how we keep like zooming out into this massive global impact that put all three of us in the same place. And then we zoom into, I would really love to just write my poetry and love the people around me and build a home that I can stay in for the rest of my life. And that would be enough as a human. Like, it's really extraordinary.
Yeah, but we're sell this idea of all these things that you have, you know. It's very easy to get lost there. When I moved here and, like, you know, we got our first apartment together here, and you, like, see you're starting from nowhere again, and you're, like, getting this thing. We're very lucky. Like, we almost all the furniture we had was free or given to us. Like, that's super cool, because people get rid of things here so easily. Like, it's so crazy how you can find things in perfect state in thrift stores just because somebody's renovating their house. That's not a thing in other places. I think people should know that. Like, that's not a thing. You don't just renovate your house and get rid of all your furniture and all your, like, electronics because you want your house to be yellow instead of pink now. That's not a thing. People are not
right? Like, oh, that. I'm tired of looking at this. I'm just going to go get all new stuff now.
Your life is so comfortable that literally having your house one color, it's boring to you. That's how comfortable your life is. It's so, like, you laugh, but it's also really sad. And I don't want this to be like me complaining about
It's 100% accurate. Like,
it's a big cultural shock, you know. It's things that are really hard to get used to.
Also, Waleska, I mean, it's fine if you've not heard Vanessa and I bitch on the internet before, but we're here to really point out to people how fucked and privileged they are most of the time. Like, that's part of who we bring onto the show, is the conversation of, like, I want to know where you're from. I want to know how you got here. I care deeply about our guests' individual journeys and experiences and perspectives. We both do, because, like, you telling Americans directly, like, that's not a thing that other people do. Your abundance is kind of disgusting, is exactly in line with what Vanessa and I are yelling at them every week. Like, look around and take stock of the way that we behave and ask yourself if you're okay with it. And even worse, are you participating in it?
Well, it's really important to, like, reorient ourselves, you know, like, before we got on this podcast this morning, you know, like, I was having a really difficult time just with everything, the reality of the way the world is and everyone's refusal and denial to, like, acknowledge that it's happening, right? So it's like, I think even pointing out something really specific, like, your life is so comfortable that you're bored with the color of your wall, and so you're just gonna spend all this money to paint it or get a new couch, or there's something wrong with your couch, right? But it's like this, and it really highlights, I think, a sickness that a lot of us have here, just, like, culturally, that is just like, oh, if I just buy something new, I might feel better. And no, we live in a very sick society, and a lot of us feel sick because of it. But instead of fixing society, we all just take pills to live in the sickness. And it's very strange that, like,
spend money. Those are the things. And pills and money.
Keep spending the money. But it is. It's just like, you know, it took me a long time. Like, I'm having a normal reaction to the society at large. But society's telling me that I am the problem. Me as an individual, I'm a woman who is fucked up and needs to take medication because there's something wrong inherently, internally in me. It's like, no, I'm having a completely normal reaction to, like, what is going on here. But again, like, we just paint the wall a different color and move on.
I really appreciate what Jen was saying about, we want to hear everybody's journey, because I started teaching our workshop for No Divide, bilingual poetry workshop, not too long ago, and where Jen's going to be our guest, by the way, and I'm very grateful for that. And we were working last Wednesday on, I was telling my students about the hero's journey for Carl, how do you say that? Jung. Okay. And I was explaining to them that the thing that made my approach to poetry really click on what I was doing was when someone told me, why people had been telling me a long time, why don't you talk about Venezuela? Why don't you ever write about Venezuela? And I was like, because I don't want to be defined by where I come from. And I was really scared about it. Also, I realized today that I was really processing all of that. Like, it was a lot, and it took me years to be able to talk about it as publicly as this to get on a stage and tell a bunch of strangers, hey, I feel ashamed when I talk about my struggle with food because I'm not thin. And I struggled with that when I was in this country, you know, and it's a lot to process. And it took me a long time. But then I realized nobody is going to be able to tell my story if not me, because everybody who went through this or something similar to this is going to have their own approach. And my approach is always going to be a unique one. And that's what I was trying to transmit my students. It was like, I need you guys to like really understand that your stories are so valuable, and that if you want to share them at some point, amazing, because nobody's going to be able to say the same things that you're saying. It doesn't matter how small the originality that's left in the world you think it is. Your journey is always going to be unique, and it's always going to be valid. And, you know, there is a lot of different stories, especially with immigration. But I really think that as we need to keep trying to create these big opportunities for people to speak their mind, because they're all going to be different, and you're all going to learn something new for all of them. And it's going to be amazing, and it's going to hurt, and it's going to burn, but you'll be fine.
Preach that good word, Waleska. Preach it. On that note, do you have any poetry that you would like to share with us today? I would love to hear a poem from you.
Yes. I picked one that is especially about these things that we've been discussing, because it was the first one that I was like, oh, okay, this, I guess I'm doing better. I can write about this now.
Wow, thank you.
So yes. I just think of Venezuela, and it's one that I've been reading a lot lately because it sums us up very good. I don't know how to write about a different landscape than the one I've left behind. My national anthem is a lullaby, and I feel something sticking in the middle of my chest when I notice a tear falling from my memoirs. Who am I? I used to have a little piece of my country in my heart, a stamp that stayed name, last name, favorite breakfast. I used to play with the sparkles that danced through infancy, the frugal memory of childhood, the jumping rope songs in the morning, the years when I could still use my bicycle. Las sesiones espiritistas haven't been able to exorcise the dictatorship's demons, leaving rent-free on my palms. I'm afraid of the color red and live television speeches. I went from milk to coffee to rum, to sleep with a machete under the bed, to not being able to sleep. Life goes on there, even though I kept moving. It's almost like I can no longer stop. The venom in my belly keeps me slow and tries to tie me down to the ground. Is it fear? Am I still scared of ghosts and clowns? I've swallowed worse things than my pride. I've been poisoned by keeping myself quiet. Calm yourself. We don't know who's listening. Think of your family. Keep it down. I forgot about the flora and the fauna, the toucan and the orchid. I can't remember how not to be loud. My peace is scattered over the Apure River, are bleeding as we speak. If they survive the piranhas in my grandma's bedtime stories, chunks of my skin still go on inside some fish's liver. Erase the face of fanatism from my eyes. No, there's more to it than what meets the mirror. There's an imposter beating the hammer, taking everything away from me. There's only so much left inside this body. Less will to start over every couple years, just a few ears to lend, not too many pats on the shoulder to give. I've grown resentment in my soul, and I fed it through the years and watered it with care. You shall not forget. The next time earlier you should run away. I constantly feel the need to escape, just in case history wants to repeat itself. Thank you.
That was incredible.
Thank you.
Wow.
Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you for listening.
There were so many lines that have caught in my throat, Waleska. That was just truly a remarkable piece of work, and the honesty in that, the ways in which you wrote the universal, kind of the sparkling of infancy and the memory of childhood. You made it available to everyone, but then you were so literal and direct and specific in afraid of the color red and live speeches. Like it was really an incredibly profound review of the way life has been in your skin. And I'm blown away by it.
Yeah. When you said the dictator's demons, I haven't been able to exercise the dictator's demons and the piranhas swimming in your grandmother's dream and your flesh still lives on. And oh my God, like the specificity and of all the senses. And I really felt like the flow of it, like we were going on this journey with you, and to be able to speak of such unspeakable things in the way that you did was just really powerful.
Thank you. This is really what I've been working on lately. And I think my biggest problem has been trying not to say the word grandma so much in all my poems, because my grandma, she raised me along with my grandpa. And because my mom, she's a single mom, you know, she was working and sustaining my grandparents and me. And it was always like that. I'm very grateful for what she did. But, you know, I was raised by my grandparents, and my grandpa passed away last year. And one thing that was painful was that when I left Venezuela, I knew that there was a lot of people that I wasn't going to be able to say goodbye to anymore. And one of those people was my grandpa. And it was like losing my dad, because he was the, you know, male figure in my life. And he raised me along with my grandma. And I think I've been really trying to like make them present in what I write. And I just need to find another word for grandma and abuela.
Poet has a word that they use, and yeah. You're allowed to use that one always, forever, as many times as you want to.
Yeah, and the piranhas are a thing with my grandma that is very like meaningful, because she grew up in Apure. You know how I was saying Apure River? That's a state in Venezuela, and there's a lot of story, because that's the plains of Venezuela. And you know how there's always a place that people are like have a lot of ghost stories and things and like weird supernatural things going on. Well, Apure is one of those, and my grandma is from there, so you can imagine how many of them I know. And it's also that river is infested with piranhas, so anybody that falls there, if you don't, like, it's gonna be impossible, they're gonna die.
You mentioned, you kind of brought up the supernatural, and I'm gonna use that as an opportunity to maybe like segue a little bit into confession and confessing, and has this played a role in your life, in your artwork, in your creativity? Is it something that means anything to you?
Do you have time? That like have hurt me, performed a lot, are probably sick and tired of me complaining about the church. Because, you know, growing up Catholic and in Latin America, it's a whole personality creation type of deal, where for a long period of your life, if you are a regular person like I was, you're going to be convinced that this is what's happening and this is the reality, and that a pigeon impregnated a woman and brought us our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. It's something that really built who I am, not because I believe in it, but because I saw it as the absolute truth for a really long time. I taught Sunday school when I was like 15. And just, I remember my grandpa asked me once, like, are you going to become a nun? Because I was like in church all the time, but because I have friends there, you know, and I had created a community there. And I am a people person. Like, I love having friends. I love hanging out with friends. And that is something that has defined me forever. So when I find friends, I make it a home for me. And when I have different groups of friends, I try to people to meet each other, so I don't have to pick who I'm going to hang out with. So I make this big group of friends. That's my thing. But I'm sorry, the church thing, the confession. Yes, when I hear confession, all I hear is Catholicism and, you know, sins. And I remember my first confession was when I was 9 years old. Can you imagine telling a 9-year-old to tell you their sins? 9 years old.
No.
That's insane. You know what I said to the priest? I was like, I have such a, like, I've built so much guilt on my soul since I was born that I had carried this my whole life until I was nine, and I was able to confess it to somebody. I told him when I was five in kindergarten, I kept this Aladdin toy from this girl that I was playing with, and I still have it. And that was like, and he laughed at me, okay?
He was, oh, sweet girl. You're so good in your heart.
No, that's when I was nine, okay? I've done a lot of bad stuff. Like, I have things to pay for, I'm sure. But I was
nine. Well, it reminds me.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say, like, my father told me a very similar story. He was raised Catholic, and, you know, they force you. And I swear to God, I think his story was, like, at 9 years old, they told me I had to go confess. And he's like, confess what? I'm nine. I haven't done anything. But they put this pressure on you. And I wonder how many, like, kids, like, make stuff up because there isn't anything to confess as a child. I'm sorry. Like, there just isn't, you know? Like, it's so bizarre.
Yeah, but there's also this thing, like, oh, you have to obey your parents. And you have to, like, you know, when I transitioned from that and I made my confirmation when I was 15. And of course by 15 you have like, oh yeah, sexual guilt, right? At that point, because you are going to be built on guilt the rest of your life. And after that, I started teaching Sunday school and I had a lot of 9 year old kids that I had to teach these things to. And you know, now, the biggest problem of these kids weren't what they were doing. It was more what was going on in their houses and what grown-ups were doing to them. Like, we had this thing like, oh, this book where the kids did their homework on, like, you know, like filling things. And I remember one of my younger students, she was like eight. And he was like, oh, do you want to like ask God for something? And she like drew something about how she really wanted her dad to stop drinking. And that was like her world, you know? And like, how am I supposed to tell this 8 year old who is drawing a picture of her dad drinking and how much that affects her at eight that she has sins to confess to a stranger, to a man that she never talks to? That was a lot for me. And I guess that was a breaking point. And when I like really started realizing that maybe this isn't true, maybe there's more to life than this. And yeah, I think the confession part of my life went to for being a big responsibility of guilt to being something that I owe to myself. And I definitely use poetry for that now, because I don't have to confess anything to anybody but myself. And poetry is nothing but an exercise of how to learn to be honest with me and how that can maybe help someone else if they want to, with consent, you know, between that.